It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 96 for Friday the 5th of October 2012. This week, Nate, that's me, returns from Japan and gets excited about the possibility of ultra-high resolution audio downloads. Plus, we'll discuss plans to digitize the brains of bees for upload into flying bee robots. And did you think that staring at pictures of kittens could improve your concentration at work? Well, it can. All that and more coming up now. Ahoy, ahoy, Nate Langston back into his house. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. I've been away for a bit, but joining me is, of course, associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And intrepid reporter Liat Clark.
Hello there.
Did you miss me?
Very much so.
Yeah.
We did, but we knew that Tokyo and Japan generally were somewhere you wanted to go so much that we kind of, we were pleased for you.
You know when you're sort of desperate to sneeze and you know it's about to come and it never does?
Yeah.
Well, imagine doing that for 10 years and then finally getting to do a giant sneeze.
Mm.
It was like that for Japan for me.
Just sneezing for
10 years
weeks.
Of waiting, and then I finally went for a while.
We didn't think you were going to come back at one point. Well, after we saw the cat cafe photos, yeah. that was almost game over for us.
I felt like you were here though. We had a lot of updates of cat pictures.
This is true. It wasn't all cats. There were robots.
Oh, yeah.
Weird underground robot dancing bars. 84-year-old sake women. Yeah. Women who serve sake, that is. Yes. Anyway, we are going to crack on with some news, and as mentioned in our little teaser just now, there are plans to upload bee brains into flying bee robots. Liv?
Yes.
What's the buzz here? What's the stinger?
That's terrible. Well, this is a team of engineers at the universities of Sheffield and Sussex, and as you said, they're literally planning to scan the brains of bees and upload them into autonomous flying robots, which will then fly and act like the real thing.
And is that the point, that they want to make robots work like real bees?
Well, they want robots to not have to be pre-programmed and to be able to make some sorts of decisions or responses to external stimuli, so that they could be used for various different things. I mean, potentially they could be used to help pollinate plants, which is what bees already do. But otherwise they could be used in kind of rescue situations to get into very small little spaces or kind of mapping.
Just to interject quickly here, what is the point of building a robot bee and uploading a bee brain into it to pollinate plants when a real bee can do so much more efficiently and cheaply?
Well, in that case, there's a problem of colony collapse disorder amongst bees, whereby they are mysteriously, their kind of populations are declining. So if we can give them a little helping bee hand, it won't be a hand, would it? It'd be a little kind of...
like a little paw.
A little paw.
But rescue bees are surely far more exciting.
Rescue, emergency SOS rescue bees is pretty awesome. Bionics, as our reporter Ian labelled them.
Okay. They can't, you know, upload the entire brain, surely. This has got to be...
No, even a bee's brain is still... there's still a huge amount of processing power going on there. So what they're doing is only taking the parts associated with the sense of smell and vision. And these will be kind of linked to pieces of software to form a sort of artificial brain that can react to any new situations, sort of as a real bee might react, but also can be controlled by the people who make them.
That's pretty cool. This is similar to something IBM did, isn't it?
Yeah,
a while ago.
IBM's been working for a while on something called the Blue Brain Project, which is aiming to model the entire human brain using processing power. Mm. And currently it hasn't actually, I don't think it's achieved that yet, but the idea is then to use it to make kind of simulations of brain behaviour to improve neuroscience.
Wow.
What other brains would we like to see scanned?
Well, someone scanned Einstein's brain. I think a doctor sort of accidentally on purpose took Einstein's brain home and then sliced it into tiny little slices. And now there's an app out that you can actually
look through
Einstein's brain.
But I think that's slightly different to mapping all the electrical activity in the brain.
Well, with that scan, they don't actually know which slides relate to which areas of the brain for all of it.
No, and
that's so quite difficult.
The key difference as well is that we're not building a robot Einstein and uploading scans of his brain into it so he can finish his work on grand unified theories of physics. But well, this is interesting, and we'll see if these bees fly. I don't know of a way of putting that in another way, but we'll keep our eye on it. I'm very excited about something the BBC is reported to be working on. According to a report in the Daily Telegraph this week, the BBC is planning to tackle the on-demand music market with a service called Playlister. And this is basically set to be a streaming service that will be free for license payers and is dubbed as the musical equivalent of the iPlayer. The BBC has decades and decades and decades of old recordings from things like TV shows where the music has been performed, or radio live sessions, or concerts that the BBC's broadcast, like Glastonbury. And this is set to be a service that basically makes hundreds of thousands of these recordings of individual songs available and at no extra cost to the public, at least in the UK.
This is awesome. But it won't be kind of all music in the same way that something like Spotify is trying to be a full catalogue of all music.
No. I mean, this is specifically recordings that the BBC itself has made, you know, which goes back... It's not quite 100 years, but it's not far off. You know, probably from 1930 onwards, the corporation's been making these recordings. So, you know, you're talking stuff like old Beatles stuff, you know, it would be part of all this, and you know, bringing it right up to more recent recordings from, you know, Coldplay. I don't know why I'm picking Coldplay as a band from now.
They seem a bit BBC, don't they?
It's a bit middle of the road, yeah. But
why haven't they done it yet?
Haven't done it yet because I think there's a huge problem with licensing. So even though the BBC owns the recordings, they still need a license or permission from individual labels. So they have been working, or at least talking to people like Spotify and Deezer and Apple on their sort of what are called bulk licensing deals. But still, the chap who's involved in making all this happen, the BBC's Director of Audio and Music, Tim Davey, says that he wants this to be his biggest legacy at the corporation. And there's no date for launch, but we're hoping for late 2012, but I'm guessing more likely early to mid-2013 is more likely.
This is great. I hope they'll put all the soundtracks of all their classic programs as well.
I'd That'd be great, yeah.
Yeah, EastEnders. Radio shows that were aired in the 30s, 40s.
But they already have the radio shows are already on the iPlayer, aren't they?
Well, not
the whole archive.
Not an archive. I mean, radio, and there's a radio-related announcement coming up next week. But they have so many recordings that are just sitting on tapes and on reels in their giant underground vault. Basically, you know, nothing's happening with them. I mean, what I wonder is that, you know, how many items on this will actually be missing? Because part of the problem with the older BBC policy is that they only had a finite amount of space to store stuff, and they were storing stuff on tape as opposed to digitally, which they're doing now. And they actually used to tape over stuff. So there are episodes of things like Doctor Who that were broadcast once or twice or whatever a few decades ago, and then the actual tapes that they were used to be broadcast from were used again.
Yeah.
And the actual, you know, they can't do a remaster or a re-release because they physically don't exist. They've had to resort to finding overseas broadcasts from other broadcasters or fan-made recordings.
I really said they can actually hunt them down.
What about the original film reel you can't record on?
Well, this is different because we're talking that they were doing all the tape recording on tape. You know, we weren't using film necessarily. So, you know, things like, I mean, there's a new Red Dwarf series, so use that as an example, starting this week. All of the old Red Dwarfs were filmed directly onto tape, not filmed.
Right,
so
I didn't realize that.
So there's a finite maximum resolution you can get from that without doing sort of software upscaling.
Oh, I see.
But anyway, my point here is that it's quite possible that there are a lot of old audio recordings that are, again, lost to this sort of BBC overwriting policy. So it'll be interesting to see if we start finding gaps in the BBC's archive on the audio side as opposed to just the television side. So anyway, that's one thing. But actually, just as on a side note, there is another related bit of news that came out this week. The British Film Institute announced this week that it's planning to digitize and make available for online viewing 10,000 vintage films. This would be a kind of so-called BFI player, if you like, and would be filmed with digital films chosen by a panel of experts, according to a BFI report. Not sure who those experts are. Probably people at the BFI. So 5,000 of these would come from the Institute's own archive, which is probably not as big as the BBC's, but it's certainly vast. And then another 5,000 films would be nominated by members of the public to make 10,000 in total to be digitised and made available by 2015.
Yeah, I'd be a bit concerned about what the public would pick from those 5,000, because apparently you can pick anything. It doesn't have to be from the BFI archives. Yeah. So we might get some dodgy choices in there.
Yeah, you would if I have anything to do with it. There's some great stuff lost to the archives, I imagine. And I think the BFI has said before that it really wants to digitise its entire archive, but this is such a tricky process because so many of these old films, which are literally film, are in, you know, there's one copy available. It might not have been preserved very well in the beginning of its life, so it's very delicate. And there's no easy way for them to get this out to the public or to cinemas. So by painstakingly digitizing these, that they could potentially open up a huge wealth of archive content that I think could be quite exciting.
Yeah, they have a ridiculous amount of stuff. If you go and look, they have films from the days of the colony, from the British Empire, and all these kind of documentaries from fishing villages in India in the middle of nowhere. Loads of kind of random archive stuff.
Do we know if they're going to be paid for or if they're going to be made available for free?
I can't imagine they would be free. You know, all of them at least. I don't know. I think possibly what it could be is that it could be like free streaming for public, private use.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll make it available to commercial uses for a fee or something like that. But at the moment, they're just sitting in the vaults, basically going rusty or moldy or both. Or something else, who knows? Anyway, let's move on. Liat, you've been writing about, well, you've not been writing about, but you've certainly been thinking about staring at kittens, and you've been saying it's going to improve your work.
Yeah, it's something I think about a lot. So next time your boss berates you for staring at videos of cute kitties, you can say to him, no, this is improving my concentration. I am a better worker for it. But the key here is they have to be kittens, not cats, according to a study called The Power of Kawaii.
Ah, that's Japanese for cute.
It is indeed.
Yeah. As I learned last week.
So it's basically investigating this phenomenon of why we all love cute pictures. And it's based on the premise of a 2009 study, which showed that exposure to pictures of baby animals made people better at playing a surgery board game. Now, the cuter the pictures got, the better the people, the group test group were at the game, the more improved the dexterity.
So was it like Operation, as in with the little pincers where you need to be calm and collected?
Yeah, exactly. So they became excellent surgeons after a few choice clips.
I would like to have more training than just staring at a picture of, you know, Maru.
And then doing the appendectomy.
Yeah. You'd like to think, yeah, this is not
how
the
down,
NHS
doctor.
Train.
No, I need a Maru video stat.
Yeah.
Shaking.
Problem is also it only works for short periods of time, apparently, is what they found. So anyway, with this new study, they carried out three experiments, basically splitting groups of people, a group of 48 candidates into two groups, exposing them to either baby or adult animal pictures. And every time the group exposed to the baby animal pictures were faster, scored higher at various games and mathematics problems that were put to them. The only time it didn't make a difference was when the group was asked to identify a letter that came up on a screen that flashed up. So basically it can improve your concentration, but not your mental faculties.
I see. I can't imagine, I wouldn't have guessed that baby photos would have been that useful, because all babies look the same, let's be honest. They all look like a variation on like a posh frog.
Yeah, but baby animals are...
Yeah, babies are not cute.
They don't look like frogs.
Most of them look like a sort of blown up, discoloured frog, I find. Okay. I can't tell the difference between one baby and another.
And a frog.
Well, no, I can tell the difference between a frog, but you know what I mean?
It's the bug eyes.
Yeah.
But this is what they say the reason could be, because we are programmed to be more attentive when we see big eyes and round face on a baby. Hence, they were using baby animal pictures rather than adult pictures had no effect. We're not cute enough. And fully
what if you've got a perfectly round face like I do?
Well, that's why I'm always staring at you in the office.
Yeah, good.
I'm interested, though, in how this affects things culturally, because this, I think, was done with Japanese test subjects, you know, who may have and to be honest, in my experience, do have a radically different perception of what is cute than, say, someone in America. I mean, there's a huge crossover, but generally speaking, when you see animals in Japanese media, for example, it is huge eyes and
uber
very cute faces,
big eyelashes.
You know, they really are kind of caricatures of cuteness itself, and that's not necessarily the same when you see, you know, the same type of animal in maybe an American or British cartoon.
Yeah, I think in Japan maybe a bit of overexposure to cuteness. So the researchers do say it could have different results if, say, they carried out the same tests on a European group, that maybe gender differences would alter the outcomes, i.e. I know women find things cuter.
Let's move on. Liv, I want to talk about excreting pure gold. I've heard it's possible.
Yep.
Can I do it?
You can't do it.
That's a shame.
Nor can I, and I don't think Liat can either.
I could try.
But researchers at Michigan State University have found that a certain type of bacteria can. Now, this particular bacterium is called Cupriovidus metallidurans.
Well done for that.
Yeah.
Say that again in a French accent.
No, non, je peux pas.
Say it in a Latin accent.
Salve. I don't know. That's my top Latin word of the day. It means hi. These bacteria can feed on gold chloride, which is a very toxic substance. It's traditionally called auric chloride, and it's a chemical compound of gold and chlorine, and it's pretty nasty stuff. But these bacteria can actually convert the gold chloride into 24-karat gold.
And they're making art out of it.
Yes. And this team, it's a microbiologist and an electrical engineer, have made a little kind of bioreactor. And they've created a piece just to explore this mechanism. So they've called it the Great Work of the Metal Lover. And it's a bioreactor with loads of bacteria in it, some of this gold chloride. And over the course of a week, people can watch very slowly the bacteria turning the gold chloride into a nugget of gold.
Wow.
So how do I go about getting one of these?
Well, it's currently on show at the Pre Ars Electronica in Austria, which is a kind of art event, interactive art event. But it's not a particularly efficient process. It's not going to be making your riches overnight. It's much more inefficient than the regular gold manufacturing techniques.
Could you label this as alchemy?
Well, they're calling it neo-alchemy. Obviously, you know, traditionally alchemists were thought to be able to turn base metals into precious metals. But in this case, they're taking something that already has gold in it and removing the kind of chlorine element. So
it's just like a fancy filter.
A fancy filter, exactly.
I bet those French alchemists are turning in their graves thinking, why didn't we think of Cupriovidus metalliduranz?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Well, let's leave gold poo in the past, because I want to talk about hate, Liat. I want to talk about Facebook hate. They've refused to take down a hate page and just today relented. What's the story here? Because this is significant. Facebook's just reached 1 billion users. So this is timely.
Yeah, I mean, they were not in the good books of the police in Victoria, Australia. An Irish expat was recently found dead and murdered. And these hate pages started cropping up on Facebook targeting the accused Adrian Bailey. Now, one of these pages even called for his execution, which racked up 44,000 likes. The reason that
this is pre-trial.
This is pre-trial. Yeah, this is, you know, the day after the body was found and he was taken into custody. So obviously, contempt law is a big issue here, and this is what the authorities immediately requested, that the pages were taken down because they don't want to unduly influence potential future jurors or jury, which is very much the same way the law operates in this country. But Facebook basically said, no, not at this time. We're going to look into it. We contacted them for a comment and they eventually got back to us to say our process is we have to have our legal advisors go through it. So it's taken probably a good 5 days after they were first asked to take it down. And in the meantime, the police have been kind of attacked by some people on Facebook for being anti-free speech. And someone actually set up a page called the Shutdown Hate Pages Relating to Adrian Osbaley, blah, blah, blah. Which was then inundated with more hate posts and accusations that he was trying to limit free speech. So I think people have gotten very irate about this one way or the other, but have kind of missed the point that the whole reason they're asking them to take it down is to ensure there is a fair trial, nothing goes wrong, and whoever is guilty is found guilty and there's no delays or dismissals.
I guess the argument is that if jurors, for example, were to see this page, it could influence their their decision.
Of course, yeah, and a lot of the pages were posting photos of the accused, and I think the argument according to law is if there's an issue of identification of the accused, then this could basically mess up the trial if you've already got photos out there. But funnily enough, even an Australian newspaper published a photo of the accused.
But with his face blacked out.
Well, his face wasn't blacked out. He basically had his arms over his head, but you could see who he was. So papers do do this quite a bit, I think, and they do it in this country. I'm always quite alarmed at some of the information that comes out.
I thought under the law over here, conventionally, you're only, once someone's been accused of something and during trial, there's only kind of five details you're able to give out about them. You're allowed to give their name, their address, their age, what they've been accused of, and I think there's something else. But beyond that, you're not really meant to talk about any of their previous like histories, any jail sentences they've had before.
But always when you pick up a story, there's some reference to, you know, a shady past or whatever it is. And they're all, you know, reporters knocking on doors. I mean, I guess Facebook did the right thing in the end. But
it took a bit of a long time.
Did it take too long?
Yeah.
Well, while we contemplate whether that did indeed take too long, we're going to have an ad break. And when we come back, we're going to discuss the launch of the X Factor for tech. The Tech Factor, maybe.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
Liv, Tech Factor then. What's going on? Simon Cowell getting into the, you know, non-vacuous, pointless and annoying TV making space.
Well,
perhaps.
Yeah, this is Simon Cowell and Will I Am teaming up to launch a new show that has this kind of working title of X Factor for Tech. That's kind of helping us conceptualize it. But the aim is to sort of find the next Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg, the next kind of tech hero in the UK. Now, Will I Am announced this when he was at the Royal Television Society Digital World Conference.
Snappy.
Snappy, rolls off the tongue. And he said it was about getting in touch with youth and giving them a platform to express themselves, whether it's in science or mathematics. Now, William has form for this sort of thing.
Yeah, you did say William again.
I think I'm just going to call him William.
Let's just carry on with William.
You know, he has form for this sort of thing. He's been promoting STEM education for quite a while. He's set up a foundation dedicated to this. That's science, tech, engineering and mathematics. And he's kind of said in the past that tech founders are the new rock stars. So the details of the actual show are fairly sketchy. But I personally think it's an absolutely fantastic idea.
I agree.
I'm not quite sure how compelling the kind of sob stories are going to be as someone's just like coding some JavaScript or what have you. I don't know how they're going to create the kind of mechanics of the show, but
the emotional attachment to the
I just love MySQL databases.
You raised me up.
Very good.
In my database cache for better algorithmic sorting. I think this could end up being something a little bit like Dragon's Den, I think.
Yes.
Although with the slightly cheesier, Cowell-esque sheen that it will undoubtedly have.
He actually tried that before in the US.
Well, they had something called like the Great Inventor or something.
Yeah, and it was basically like Dragon's Den, but in the US, and it flunked. So I think they're trying to rejig it.
But I just want to know what the qualifications are for being a judge on this, because I mean, Cal, whatever you think of him, he has at least been in the music industry for a long, long time. He knows exactly what it is he's looking for, and he knows what he's looking for to make a band successful, regardless of, you know, whether that's something that we deem admirable or not. He does know that. Does he know about, you know, what makes a great talented coder or engineer?
I hope he'll hire some other judges. We don't know who the judges are yet, so.
And he does know what makes a great business, I think. And I think Will.i.am has the kind of acumen on the tech side a little bit more.
Well, he does work with Intel, and I know he's a bit of a tech head, but he's not coming from a very heavily invested tech background, either engineering or reporting or PhD in computer science, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, no. They need a third judge with a bit more weight to them.
It should be me. I reckon I should do it.
We'll nominate you.
Yeah, nominate me.
Nate for Sex Factor. What's it called?
Not called Sex Factor.
Sex Factor would be a very different show.
We now called it Tex Factor, but that sounds like Texas Tex Factor.
Tex-Mex Factor.
Develop the next nacho topping.
Now that is something I could judge.
Yeah.
be thrilling. Well, we will keep our eye on this. And I'm very keen to see who other judges on this panel would be, because I think that's what this is all going to hinge on. Because if you actually get someone like, I don't know, let's say Tim Berners-Lee and, I don't know, someone from MIT Media Lab judging this. They're, to me, going to be far more interesting to watch them criticize or put judges through, or sorry, put contestants through and things like that.
Yeah, than or someone Ian who's Livingston just, or someone like
that. Yeah, than someone who's maybe just looking for who's got the best idea for the next website or streaming music service, which are a dime a dozen.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a very interesting idea. I think it... it could go one or the other way, but we'll see. The last thing I want to talk... fairly obvious. I want to touch on one more thing before we finish the show, and that is about audiophile music. Now, Liv and Leah, I want to ask you a question. How happy are you two with the quality of digital music downloads, the sound quality?
I enjoy it. It doesn't bother me too much. I don't think it's poor.
You don't think it's poor? You don't think it's exceptional?
Well, now that I've got my nicer earphones, like
now
before, I didn't really, I didn't have a sophisticated enough ear to tell.
Earballs
weren't sophisticated enough. But now that I've got my nice headphones, I do notice that quite a big difference between the CDs that I have and the digital music that I listen to.
Interesting. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I am a big fan of high-end music systems. It's something I've reviewed for many years as well. And it's interesting what's happening in the news this week. So just as a primer, the standard quality for music downloads is about 256 kilobits per second, which is only a fraction of the resolution of a CD version, which is 1,411 kilobits per second. So there's already a big difference there. But CDs are just a fraction of the original studio recording, which are somewhere in the region of 24 bit or higher and 192 kilohertz instead of 44.1. So basically the point we're making here is that the music you download is significantly lower quality than what actually occurred in the studio recording. Neil Young, who is a musician you've probably heard of, wants to address these audio downloads with a new audio format called Pono or Pono. I'm not sure how I meant to pronounce
that. Such a wonderful name.
Yeah. And this would be a music download service that offers music at 24-bit, 192 kilohertz qualities and be compatible with a new portable audio player that you would use to play them on. And Young is understood to have signed up the three major record labels, that's Sony, Universal and Warner, for a launch of the service in 2013. Now, this excites me hugely because I've wanted... I still buy CDs, partly because I do like to own the CDs and have a physical backup, but largely it's because my headphones are really expensive and my hi-fi system at home is really expensive. You invest a lot of money in getting the best possible music experience. You don't want to feed low quality downloads into that because it negates the point of having the good speakers or headphones. So this is of huge interest to me.
This makes sense, but what about the hardware? Do we really need another piece of kit?
Well, we're all going to have to buy Sony, surely, if this comes into effect.
It might not be made by Sony. We don't know who's going to make the player, but the reason we need a dedicated piece of equipment for this is that current players won't play music at that resolution. It's so significantly higher than what current players can physically output that you need... at least to alter the hardware in current players, but this would necessitate, at least in the earlier stages, the launch of a dedicated player.
Which you could attach to your sound system at home.
Although I would imagine there would also be desktop software that you could download so you could put the files on a, through your hi-fi or something like that.
So how dramatic do you think the difference will be? Will it be like jumping from tape to CD?
Well, this is the thing. There are so many other factors at play here, and it's one thing having incredibly high-resolution music, but there are some other problems. So, for example, the headphones that that you get with an iPod are physically incapable of delivering a noticeable change in quality. It doesn't matter if you ramp up the audio quality to sort of a studio resolution. The headphones are, very cheap. They're just bog standard. They're not going to hear it. You're not going to hear anything through it. Whereas if you sit at home using a dedicated headphone amplifier and some nice hi-fi headphones, that cost probably several hundred quid, then you will notice the difference. And you can tell the difference. Most people can. But there is another problem, which is that the older you get, the less your ears respond to high and low frequencies. So you get a much narrower range of frequencies that you can actually perceive. So even if you have amazing headphones and amazing sound quality that has this incredibly huge bandwidth for resolution, if you're perhaps in your 60s and your hearing resolution is narrowed to such an extent that you can't hear the benefit, then it doesn't matter how high quality that music is, because you're not really going to get the benefit for it. But it is really interesting, and people who, you know, say they can hear the differences in standard resolution to ultra high resolution audio, you know, will probably be very excited by this. It won't be mass market, but if they've got three major labels on board to re-release, you know, perhaps their back catalog, and you've already got high-end gear at home, even if you do have to just buy your favorite albums again, a lot of people will be able to hear them in a way they've never been able to hear them before, because they've been limited, and I'm saying that in air quotes, to CD resolution. So,
and presumably they take quite a lot longer to download as well, though, right?
And the files will be huge. They'll be very, very big.
Do you have any idea like how big a single song might be?
Well, if you take, say, and we don't know the exact format of the songs, but if you say an uncompressed CD audio file of, say, 5 minutes would probably be about 50 or 60 megabytes uncompressed. So if you triple that resolution, say, you might be looking at 150 meg per song. If they compress that and keep the resolution but do a lossless compression, maybe you could get that down to maybe 100 meg or something per song, so maybe a gigabyte per album. So this portable player would need to have quite the storage capacity.
Have like three songs.
But you know, we've got used to downloading things. I mean, if you look at a just one TV show download from iTunes, you're looking at sort of 300 megabytes. You download a movie and you might be downloading 4 or 5 gig if you choose an HD option, or even higher. So with broadband being the state it's in now, those sort of file sizes actually shouldn't be seen as a turn-off, because really, compared to movies, they're still a fraction of the size. Anyway, let us know what you think, because we're going to wrap up the show now. podcast@wired.co.uk. Would you be interested in buying an ultra-high resolution audio player? I have to say, for the record, I will be buying one. I think it sounds great.
What if it's £1 million?
Then I'll get one for review and use it for 2 weeks and then send it back. But we just wanted to point out, we've actually got a new issue of the magazine out this week, and it is a special issue all about the MIT Media Lab. These are the guys over in Massachusetts in the US who are pioneering some incredible science and technology and engineering solutions for the future, if you like. bionic limbs and all kinds of incredible stuff. And we've dedicated the entirety of November's issue, which is out now, to some of the amazing stuff that's going on. I mean, I know we speak with considerable bias, but of all the issues that the Mag guys have put out over the last couple of years, I have to say this is possibly one of my favorites. There really is some insane stuff in here, and it's out on tablets as well as of this week. Liv, tell people how they can get in touch.
As ever, you can get in touch with us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. We have a fantastic Facebook page as well, facebook.com/WiredUK. And you can also email us, podcast@wired.co.uk.
And we should note as well that Wired 2012 is our annual conference. It's coming up at the end of this month, and we're all getting very, very excited about some of the speakers. We have, I think, still a few tickets left. They've pretty much gone.
I think so. They're selling out quite quickly, but we have... some fantastic speakers.
We do. They are good. But we have a chance to win a pair of, one ticket actually to the event.
Okay.
So if you go to wired.co.uk and have a look in our sort of little navigation bar, you will see a link to win Wired 2012 tickets or something like that. And you could potentially come down and watch us record a live podcast at the show as well. So until next time, Liv, Liat, it has been nothing but a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye.